The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Monday, April 29th, 2024. 7 minutes past the hour, I'm Eric White filling in for Tom Temin. Our producer is Peter Masurlian. Our web editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darius Lauderdale. Coming up this hour of the Federal Drive, after getting past the arguments of foreign aid, Congress may finally be able to get down to business. Plus, we hear from the new head of the National Institutes of Health. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of the Federal Drive. First, Martin O'Malley spent the first month of his term as the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration on the road. During January, he met with employees across all 9 SSA regions to learn about their challenges and the opportunities to improve customer service. During Federal News Network CX Exchange, O'Malley tells executive editor Jason Miller about how these meetings led him to implement an agile for government approach.
On an every 2-week basis, not every year, not every 2 years, not quarterly, but every 2 weeks, we gather about 12 of the most important people around the table, the deputy commissioners who are responsible for the operations of this agency. And let's be honest, I mean, all of them are important. There's 22 deputy commissioners, but there's a reason why a jury has 12 people and not 22. So we gather as a group. It's the Deputy Commissioner for Budget and Finance, our new CIO. It is also the Head of Operations, our new Chief Operating Officer. But critically important at that table is Betsy Bowman, who is the head of the relatively new office here called the Office of Transformation. And it is from Betsy's office that that critically important customer service research is emanating. And she is able, while the operational people are talking about workflows, she's able to talk about the customer journey and ask questions based on the customer journey. For example, people that are applying for disability claims give us pretty high ratings once they about getting an appointment, about getting into the office, about having the process explained to them. But then in a sort of red light, green light fashion, we see from our research that we totally fall down when it comes to the time they have to wait to have their disability determination rendered by the state, what we call the DDSs, the Disability Determination Services. And so that tells us that we need to do a much better job of letting people know, even in the extended process, which has been exacerbated by the low level of staffing, we need to let people know where they stand in the process. Because in America today, if people can order a t-shirt over Amazon from China and be able to track that, how much more important is their disability determination to be able to track? So having Betsy there at the table to inject into our conversations and the critical questioning of how we do what we do and how we can do it better, I think has been one of the most fundamental changes we've made. Because whether it's the Medallia survey on how people are treated on our really challenged 1-800 number or calling the field offices or any other service, that should inform just as much as the worker experience, how we do what we do and where we need to improve the most and the most urgently.
Appreciate the story of bringing in all the folks together. Obviously, every 2 weeks, you're bringing in 12 other people or a subset of that 12 to continue the conversation. What are you looking at from a commissioner's perspective? You want to see things get better. You want to see where obstacles are that you can help remove. I get that. But maybe go a step further down and say, what are you specifically listening for? Because I don't think a lot of people, you have so much going on that a lot of people may say, oh, well, only the big things come to your level. And that's probably, I would probably argue that's probably not true.
Oh, don't they wish? No, lots of things come to my level. In fact, within the first full month that I was here, I traveled all 9 regions. When I went to all of these places, I sat on the co-pilot headsets with the people in the teleservice centers. I sat down with the people for a long stretch that were interviewing customers that came in to the field offices. And I came, and we also did town halls not a big speech, and then I blow out of there after reading 20 pages of well-prepared remarks. But it was very much, it was much more like a mayoral town hall, except this was with employees serving our customers, to understand the things that drive them crazy, that keep them from doing their job effectively and quickly, which is really, really important when we're laboring under the lowest staffing we've had in 27 years. And it's been 9 long years since Congress has even had the courtesy to give us a budget or appropriation hearing. So I came back with a lot of very actionable ideas, that had been, you know, in the absence of a commissioner with an operational background, were things that people got frustrated trying to send up. Because let's be honest, in a big organization, it becomes easier to say no than it does to say yes, especially when things are in the policy silo, things are in the law silo, things are in the cybersecurity silo, things are in the CIO silo. But having people around that table allowed us to remove barriers. Let me just give you one example. When I was sitting with a young man in a cubicle up in Boston, his name was David, and he was showing me, you know, the very old legacy IT systems that he has to, you know, databases that he has to go back and forth through like a trapeze artist in order to process a single claim. And before I left, he said, let me just show you one more thing before you leave. And he said, this is an actual SSI application. And he says, keep in mind, we've already talked to this person who's in dire need. And we've already talked to him as a human being to determine that they qualify, because it's an income-based program. We have to determine that they don't have any money. And look what I have to do to process the claim. Question, do you have any money? Answer, no. Second question, do you have a checking account? No. Another click of another button. Third question, do you have a savings account? Well, hell's bells, I already told you no. Third button. He showed me 41 buttons, like, do you have a Cayman Islands account? Do you have cash you've hidden under granny's mattress? No, 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 no. He said, please, commissioner, my firstborn for a no to all button. Now, that might sound like a small, simple thing. And in a sense, it is. But if you are dealing with an organization whose staffing is at a 27-year low and your customers are at an all-time high, having to spend that amount of time all across an agency, you know, they measure things here in work years. How much could one person working an entire year produce, if you will, in that system? So it's the little things like that that are racking up and base hits, if you will. Every now and again, we get a double. And soon we'll start hitting triples and maybe even an occasional home run. But those are the things that, taken collectively and together, to improve customer service and to improve the worker experience. And let's be honest, they're flip sides of the same coin when you're in an entirely human serving organization. Those are the things that are going to allow us to tackle the big three challenges that the president asked me to tackle here. One is the 1-800 number, where people wait for 40 minutes, hour, sometimes an hour and a half. The second one is the time it takes for disability determinations, initial disability determinations. And the third one is the injustice we do to people through overpayments and underpayments, and our congressional mandate to recover those overpayments when we discover that they've happened.
So I've asked the questions, the obvious question. Are those 41 buttons down to one no to all? Is that done yet?
I know it's in fact, thank you for making me conclude the story. We came back and with the CX team and with our CIO and also the people in operations, we were able to actually do an A-B test that we sent out there to our frontline workers to say which version of this no to all button do you prefer? So we tested that. That was a new thing. That's not something this agency has typically done. Typically, new systems take 7 years to produce. They come from headquarters, and then they roll down from the sky, land on the field offices without ever testing them with the workers. So we tested the note all button within, as I recall, about a week, maybe 10 days. And then we deployed it within a week after the testing came back, saying that the workers wanted that. And then I went into, you know, the camera, sent out a broadcast short little video to the workers, and there was rejoicing in there was rejoicing throughout SSA that we were listening, that we were mindful of customer experience and worker experience, that we actually asked their colleagues which one they preferred, and then we deployed it. We also did that with another thing that allowed us to, it was invented actually back in 2011 on Excel by one of our people in the Birmingham office or in the Atlanta region. And it took the 8 minutes that's typically required to process a Medicare-only claim, and it shrank it to 8 seconds. And then would pause on all of those pages if an anomaly was identified by the machine that said maybe somebody elected Part D when their circumstances said they could should have gotten Part B. So why did that not happen? Why could that be invented in 2011? And not be approved? Because legal had some questions. Cyber, you needed to get an authority to operate. CIO had other things above the line in their product development. And yet, that one little thing, which had gone up the flagpole over three or four commissioners and acting commissioners since 2011, never got approved until now. And we were able to turn around an ATO on that within four days. Well, not the full ATO, but an authority to deploy it. And we were able to get those other people to check off. And you know, that saved 40 work years across this agency by being able to have that tool. So these are the things we're working on. We're not waiting annually to deploy them. We're deploying them every couple of weeks.
Martin O'Malley is the commissioner of the Social Security. Martin O'Malley is the commissioner of the Social Security Administration. Listen to his full interview and find all of our CX Exchange discussions on federalnewsnetwork.com. Search CX Exchange. Still to come on Federal News Network, we hear from the new head of the National Institutes of Health. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Back in November of last year, the National Institutes of Health welcomed its 17th director, Monica Bertagnoli. Operating the government's health research wing in a post-pandemic environment comes with a set of different challenges than what her predecessors dealt with. I recently got the chance to speak with her about that and what she's learned so far just 6 months on the job. You've been on the job now for just over 7 months or so, or coming up on the 7 month anniversary. Any observations so far or lessons learned right off the bat just in these first few months?
Well, I think there's two things that I can say. First of all, what has been wonderful is just the camaraderie and willingness across all the different 27 institutes and centers of the NIH, who all have their own amazing leaders, of me in this position, seeing such camaraderie and willingness to work together and track record of working together across all those different leaders. That's, I think, truly exceptional and illustrates a great commitment toward really doing whatever it takes to improve health for people. I had heard before I arrived in this position that, you know, watch out for silos, watch out for, and I'm really pleased to say that while we still have silos and we have a tremendous willingness from everyone to eliminate those and work together as never before, which has been really wonderful. The other thing I will say that is a surprise to me, but a really wonderful one, is the willingness of the other heads of agencies across HHS to also work together. The understanding that, you know, NIH represents the main research arm of the effort, but we have so much to gain from working with partners across all of HHS, and we're now getting ready to do some, I think, really transformative work together, and that's also been great.
Yeah, coming from the National Cancer Institute, were there any assumptions that you had about the role that maybe turned out to not be true, or, you know, vice versa? Was there something that you didn't quite see? You know, you were from a pretty high view before, but now you're even higher view about the agency itself.
I think that's the main one I've already described, you know, at NCI, and I was only there for a year. I was just barely getting my feet wet. You know, at NCI, I was intensely focused on that institute itself and all of its workings and really trying to optimize all the functions of NCI, and really hadn't yet lifted my head to think what was possible across the broader scope of NIH. So I think that's the major difference. The director really needs to think about every corner of NIH and the relationship of NIH to all of the other external parties. So it is a completely different job, frankly.
Yeah, let's get into the role of NIH. You had mentioned that you're the research effort of the HHS mission, but do you see an evolving role of the National Institute of Health, especially in, let's say, at a post-COVID world?
We always have an evolving role. Okay, we have two aspects to what we do. First, we understand that at NIH, our work has to encompass the research laboratory, it has to encompass the clinic, and it cannot stop at the door to the doctor's office. It also has to fully encompass all of the communities that we serve. And those communities include, you know, rural sites in America, they include busy metropolitan areas, and they also include the rest of the world, where lessons in health are critical. And so we constantly have to maintain an infrastructure that can serve that really, really broad environment. And then also, as COVID illustrated, be able, when needed, to be in reactive mode, because we can't always anticipate what new threats are going to arise. And I'll say that evolving, all of biomedical research evolves constantly, but our focus is on maintaining that infrastructure so that we make progress all the time, so that we also are ready to jump in whenever we need to react to a new threat.
Can we get a little specific there? What changes have you seen across the agency and maybe, and you know, just the national health strategy overall coming out of, you know, still being able to smell the fires of the COVID pandemic?
Well, I'll just raise a couple because there are so many. But let me give you the ones that I think are the highlights. Number one, the fragility of so many communities within the United States in particular, the disproportional impact on some communities that are experiencing health disparities of that virus. That one just reminds us every single day that we have to overcome those disparities. So it highlighted that as never before. Again, something that we had been targeting, but it just made it so much more real to everyone to see how hard hit those communities were. Number two, the trust issue that was uncovered by the COVID-19 pandemic. Someone will say that, you know, the current environment created this trust issue. You know, I think the trust issue must have been there even before, and perhaps the COVID pandemic really highlighted it. I think this has taught us in the biomedical research community that we can't just put out our knowledge, put out what we've learned, and expect everyone just to take it in and act upon it. We have to earn the trust of communities that lack it. And this, again, drives us to be better listeners and better partners to communities of need out there who really are experiencing disproportionate effects to health challenges. And I think has redoubled our dedication to listening to people and delivering what they need, not just assuming that our research is going to speak for itself. And that is taking us in a new direction that I think is very powerful.
Monica Bertagnoli is director of the National Institutes of Health. Hear the second part of this interview after this quick break. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Back on the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. We now continue part two of my interview with Director of the National Institutes of Health, Monica Bertagnoli.
you know, as the research wing of the government's health program, it almost seemed as if during the pandemic, just the process of health research just came under intense scrutiny. You know, everybody was learning kind of on the go. Has NIH taken any steps towards maybe improving that trust or in the actual process itself and saying, hey, you know, we're researching here. We're not necessarily going to have all the right answers right away. Was that sort of the seed of some of the issues that you saw?
No, I would take that in a little bit different direction and say that research means that people out there, all the people in the communities we serve, have to be part of the answers, right? You know, we can't produce answers that say, here's what you need to do to stay healthy, unless we have people out there who are our partners in being able to deliver those answers. That's number one. And then number two, and this is the one that I think I have taken most to heart, is that the people who were in communities of disparity, the people who have had the least trust in the results of research, were the ones who were left out of research. So if we're going to get those answers, we have to convince people that everyone needs to be part of helping us find those answers.
Yeah, and on the note of inclusivity, you are the second woman to ever run the NIH. You know, what can you speak about the rise in female leadership that you're seeing, particularly in the medical field?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. And I think it is the result of decades of sustained progress in eliminating unconscious bias and ensuring that the best minds and those with the best passion are able to assume leadership jobs, and that there shouldn't be kind of these inappropriate, let's say, roadblocks to people getting there. And I think we're seeing that for women. We're seeing that for many other aspects of our communities. You hear us talk a lot about also promoting inclusion of various other perspectives in biomedical research and in leadership. And I think the need, again, to get deeply into the communities we serve are another aspect of that. Not only am I a woman, I'm somebody who grew up in a very remote rural community. And that's just another segment of our society, example of someone whose voice I think we need if we're going to conquer problems for everybody.
Gotcha. And can you speak to any particular advancements so far that you are proud of, you know, or, you know, I know you've only been at it for 7 months, so the list of accomplishments may not be as long as one might hope, or anything that you are working towards that you are really trying to take an interest in and have a driver's seat role in?
So one of them is, it comes from being a doctor in a clinic, also being a researcher, kind of a spectrum of research, but also being a doctor in a clinic and sitting there thinking, you know, I know what kind of data and data quality I need if I'm going to publish a new manuscript. And I also sat in clinic and realized, look at the data quality that I'm using to make life-altering decisions with my patients day in and day out. And let me tell you, the data quality doctors and patients are using in the clinic is not where we would like it to be, because these decisions have incredible implications for people, you know, far more than, frankly, than me publishing a paper. So I have been committed for a long time in really improving our ability to deliver data that is of very high quality and can really be much better at letting our doctors and patients make critical decisions in clinic every day. And so those are some of the things that we've launched already. And these data have to come from all aspects of biomedical research, from the laboratory all the way to the communities. So we have a number of initiatives that we've already launched, making sure that we gather more data from the clinical care environment. We work not only in NIH, but across all of HHS to do so, and that also we integrate this with what's coming out of our laboratories in a way that lets us return real results to our patients and our care providers.
Did you happen to speak with any of your, well, I'm sure you have, but your predecessors, did they have any advice for you? We spoke to Dr. Francis Collins a lot on this very program about some of these issues as well. What were some of the tips and tricks that they had left behind for you?
Oh, I was so fortunate that my predecessors have been incredibly generous. Dr. Elias Zerhouni, Dr. Harold Varmus, and certainly Francis Collins have been not only given me incredible support as I entered the position, but still are constant advisors to me. Each of them brings a different and very powerful lens to this job. And so they have been incredibly helpful, supportive, and they are constant advisors still.
It really is kind of a grab bag as far as NIH directors go, as far as where their area of expertise is and, you know, the position they held before, usually running one of the institutes themselves. Does that speak to the NIH's kind of collaboration that you had spoken about earlier and the diversity of fields really coming together and why it makes the agency so unique?
Oh, absolutely. You know, no individual can come into this job with everything that you need to be able to address the depth and breadth of what NIH needs to tackle. You know, and I think each of us were chosen for a particular qualities at the time that might be some of the most emergent issues, but each of us also needs what the others have already brought in. So I agree. I think I have the benefit of being the NIH director who has actually a total of many NIH directors being able to help with the job.
This may be the hardest question I ask you because it's self-analysis. Why do you think you were chosen?
I think it was because we find a time when it is very helpful to have somebody with a strong scientific background, but who's also been a doctor in the clinic, seeing patients every day up until the time I came on as NCI director and bringing the perspective of the doctor in the clinic.
Finishing up, I have to pick your doctor brain. How good are blueberries for my digestive system? Because I had a lot of them this morning and I want to feel good about myself.
I have no idea.
No.
I will say that in my previous experience in looking for better ways to improve diet, that blueberries do have some wonderful antioxidants, which if we take them out of blueberries and concentrate them and use them in our model systems, they're very helpful for preventing cancer and inflammation. What that means when you actually eat blueberries, I'm afraid I don't know.
That's Monica Bertagnoli, Director of the National Institutes of Health. You can find this entire interview on our website at federalnewsnetwork.com. You can also subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Federal News Network, after getting past the arguments of foreign aid, Congress may be able to finally get down to business. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. All right, now that the issue of giving money to U.S. allies is over with, Congress can return to the task of dishing out cash to federal agencies, as lawmakers are finally able to start work on appropriations for the 2025 fiscal year. However, there are still some rumblings from within the Republican Party that Speaker Mike Johnson may have to worry about down the line. To get an update from Capitol Hill, we welcome Maeve Sheehy, congressional reporter with Bloomberg Government. Maeve, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So those appropriations are finally going to start happening after all the squabbling has finished up and they can finally get back to business. Is that the case?
Well, they'll definitely be able to start working on them. It's kind of interesting that we're talking about 2025 appropriations bills starting right now because it's midway through 2024 and we just finished the 2024 funding bills. So it's an interesting place for Congress to be in. And you'll remember that last time Congress tried to get all 12 appropriations bills done, didn't go great. They ended up in two minibuses. And there were a lot of fights within the GOP about things like a mifepristone rider, for example, and other kind of social issues that got tacked on. So there's really no reason to believe that won't also happen for 2025 appropriations bills. And given that they run out at the end of September, we're probably looking at another continuing resolution at some point.
Yeah, and with these, you know, some lawmakers being up for election and they want to really highlight those social issues, are there any sort of ones that, you know, may be right out in front? Are we going to see another holdup of defense promotions, things of that nature?
There could be, for sure. I mean, now that the Ukraine funding has passed, that kind of foreign aid caused a lot of issues within the conference, but now that issue has gone away. So Republicans will need to work on other issues that they want to kind of campaign on. There are some so-called culture wars that could be tacked on, like with LGBTQ rights, with abortion, that's a big one. But what you'll see, which is really interesting, is that even while more conservative House lawmakers are trying to get these front and center in appropriations bills, the more moderate Republicans don't really want that to be part of this because there are a lot of them are in competitive districts. So if they want to win to Democrats and win over some independent voters, they probably don't want abortion to be front and center.
Yeah, and those moderate Republicans may have to look to the other side of the aisle again for some help. Is that going to be the case in making sure that business continues as usual for government agencies?
It certainly could be. To get some sort of continuing resolution done, that probably can't be done with just Republican votes because you do have this kind of right flank of the Republican Party in the House that is just very conservative and very against continuing resolutions, or CRs as they're called around here. They don't want any stopgap funding. And so we could be headed for a government shutdown if there can't be some sort of bipartisan compromise to keep the government open.
Don't say government shutdown. I don't need those hours that much. And I'm sure you don't either.
No, I mean, we got kind of close to them a few times in the past year. So in September, we might be looking at that again.
We're speaking with Maeve Sheehy. She is the House reporter for Bloomberg Government. And another program that Congress is going to have to deal with, the Affordable Connectivity Program. You may or may not have heard of it, and it kind of spans all parts of the country, as it is internet subsidies for low-income households, whether in the city or especially out in rural areas. What can you tell me about what is happening there?
Yeah, so the FCC had requested about $6 billion for Congress to appropriate so that they could keep this program running. It helps a lot of people. It reaches about 23 million households across the country. And in some states, like in Louisiana, 1 in 3 households are directly benefited from it. Basically gives them a discount on their internet. And it's really popular among providers. If you look at lobbying reports, you'll see that Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, they all spent money to lobby on this issue in the past quarter because it benefits them when people can get high-speed internet, basically. But the funds will run out this week at the end of the month. So at the end of April is what the FCC has said. And so unless Congress can act really quickly, which, as we've seen, does not necessarily happen in this Congress, there will be a lapse. So a lot of households will be looking at higher internet bills. Some people might not be able to pay their internet bills. And obviously in this kind of modern era where so many things are virtual, that's going to be a really big problem for people.
Is it more of just a procedural hurdle that this program is facing, or are there some principled stances being taken on as far as, you know, the actual basis of the program?
So if you look at a bill that would extend the program, the majority of Congress is signed on. So a lot of Republicans are in favor of this, especially Republicans in competitive districts who, you know, maybe some of their voters actually benefit from this. But then on the right, the far right of the GOP, you see some people saying that they want the program to sunset because they see it as kind of corporate welfare. They see it benefiting like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast. And their argument is that if the program is allowed to end, then these companies won't be getting kind of kickbacks and they'll end up passing along lower costs for internet to the consumer. There's a big divide within the House GOP about that, which is pretty interesting to watch. And Mike Johnson will need to navigate that, because if he does decide to put a bill on the floor that would extend the program, he's going to have some people from the right of his party who are not too happy with him.
Other than, you know, the FCC reporting on what's going to happen, has the agency said anything about the potential impact if this does not come to fruition?
The agency has been trying really hard to get Congress to extend this. It's something that they've said is really important to closing the digital divide. I mean, we saw after COVID that a lot of people do not have high-speed internet or don't have internet access at all. And so the FCC has kind of billed this as a really important part of the Biden administration's efforts to get people online so that they can go to work or go to school or go to telehealth appointments or something like that.
Gotcha. All right. And you had talked about it a little bit there in your previous answer, as far as Speaker Mike Johnson having to navigate these tricky waters within his own party. You know, he got past the argument whether or not Israel and Ukraine should receive the funding from the U.S. government, but he may have not come out of that unscathed. What could he be seeing down the line as far as more agitation from within his own party?
Yeah, so there are 3 members currently who are advocating for an ouster. They want to force a motion to vacate, which you'll remember is what Matt Gaetz did to Kevin McCarthy, no longer speaker, so we've seen how that goes. But there are 3 members of the party who are publicly calling for Mike Johnson to be ousted. And if they put that on the floor for a vote, then it will come down to whether Democrats join them or not. Democrats joined to oust McCarthy, but they also had like years of trust issues Whereas with Johnson, he's more of a blank slate. And some Democrats have said that they'd be willing to save him, if they can move forward as sort of a bipartisan governing coalition, as Minority Leader Jeffries likes to say. So if Johnson is bailed out by Democrats, that also puts him in an interesting situation, because there are a lot more members in his party who would see that as kind of a betrayal. They don't want to work across the aisle.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about how it happened last time for Kevin McCarthy. Could we start to maybe see any rule changes from the next Congress as far as selecting a speaker or having these votes come forward? You know, could we see that you may be required to have more support before even bringing this to the House floor, just because of how this is kind of holding things up now, of Congress actually getting anything done?
Absolutely. So last Congress, when Pelosi was speaker, there was a higher threshold for the amount of members who needed to bring this motion to vacate to the floor. And then when Kevin McCarthy was trying to win the speaker vote way back last year, he needed to make some tough deals with hardline conservatives in his party so that they would vote for him. And one of those deals was that just one member could bring the motion to vacate to the floor. And as we've seen over the past year, that has caused huge turmoil in the House. So we have basically a small group of members that could unseat a speaker, theoretically, because there's such a tight margin in the House. The next Congress, I definitely think that we'll have at least a very concentrated group of people trying to push for a higher threshold. So just one member could not necessarily derail a party like this. And there was actually some talk a couple weeks ago where more mainstream members of the Republican Party were saying, hey, maybe we can change this now. And there were maybe like 3 hours where Johnson seemed to be considering it. And then he very publicly tweeted out they wouldn't be changing those rules because he said they don't have a majority of the House that would approve that rules change.
Yeah. And it's almost like he'd be getting rid of the rule that is the reason why he's in that position anyway, right?
Yeah, it would be tough politically for him for sure. And it also might not be workable to actually get across the floor.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait and see on that one. Maeve Sheehy is a House reporter for Bloomberg Government. Thank you so much for giving us an update on what's going on Capitol Hill.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find this interview at our website on federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. You can also subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. 57 past the hour. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Up next, the top national headlines from CBS News and the Federal Newscast. I'm Eric White, filling in for Tom Temin.
The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Monday, April 29th, 2024. 7 minutes past the hour, I'm Eric White filling in for Tom Temin. Our producer is Peter Masurlian. Our web editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up this hour of the Federal Drive, after getting past the arguments of foreign aid, Congress may finally be able to get down to business. Plus, we hear from the new head of the National Institutes of Health. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of the Federal Drive. But first, leaders at top AI firms, including OpenAI, Google, and Microsoft, have been named to a new Department of Homeland Security panel. DHS announced the new members of its AI Safety and Security Board late last week. The group will provide recommendations for using AI in critical U.S. systems. For more on this, we turn to Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. Justin, thank you so much.
Hey, Eric, how's it going?
Very well. So, tell us more about the mission of this AI Safety and Security Board and just who's going to be sitting on it.
Yeah, so this board is an outgrowth of President Joe Biden's executive order on AI that was released just last year. And the AI Safety and Security Board is really intended to provide recommendations to DHS, but more broadly, perhaps across the federal government and the private sector, on the safe and secure development and deployment of AI technology into critical infrastructure. And so this board is really going to be one of those advisory committees that provides DHS with some pretty big recommendations on, you know, of course, things that people are worried about, how AI might be deployed into a system like the energy grid or something like that. And so the board, as you teased out, includes some pretty heavy hitters in the AI space. It includes Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, Dario Adomai, the CEO of Anthropic, and then Satya Nadella, the chairman and CEO of Microsoft, and Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Alphabet, Google's parent company. So those are four of the big AI firms working on generative AI, and they will all be part of this 22-member board that DHS has put together.
22 members from the AI community. I imagine a lot of ideas are going to get tossed around. How will the board potentially influence DHS policy? And are they going to be looking more at the responsibility side or the safety side?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be a mix of both at this point. I think responsibility, there's clearly a lot of private sector participation here. I mean, those four firms that I mentioned are kind of considered the big four AI firms. But then you also have the CEO of computer chip firm NVIDIA, as well as the CEO of IBM. So those are the computer chips that are powering really a lot of AI and machine learning systems, really central to those systems. You also have, the CEO of Delta Airlines on there. So that brings in the kind of air travel component of this and the airline component. The co-director of Stanford's Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence Institute is on the board, as are several people who are involved in civil rights and human rights to kind of take that tact on it as well. But really, if you look down the 22 members on this board, it's a lot of technology corporations that are involved here. So there's going to be this involvement of the corporations who are driving the AI space now providing recommendations to DHS on how they should potentially, secure AI and, maybe or maybe not put some regulations in place as well. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this board in the way of recommendations that go up to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and his team in the coming months and years.
Yes, it will be. And I imagine the agency doesn't want to fully depend on the private sector to give all of its suggestions on how and when AI should be utilized. What is DHS itself doing when it comes to AI safety and security?
Yeah, so DHS has already got a couple of things in the motion when it comes to AI safety and security. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency is leading a lot of DHS's work in that arena. DHS put out a roadmap, an AI roadmap in March, and it shows that CISA is actually working to publish AI security guidance at some point in this year, in 2024. So CISA puts out a lot of cybersecurity guidance. Now they're going to be putting out some AI-specific guidance. And then CISA, the Transportation Security Administration, and the Coast Guard are all working to evaluate the potential risks to the use of AI in critical infrastructure sectors. DHS is worried about how the use of AI in critical infrastructure could result in failures, physical attacks, or cyber attacks. So this is something where DHS agencies are already kind of tuned into, and they're already looking at these areas. And now this AI safety and security board, with this heavy involvement from the private sector, will also weigh in on some of those areas as well.
We're speaking with Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. And so how is DHS itself looking to use AI internally?
Yeah, there's quite a few use cases that DHS has already named. Some are in deployment already. They consider TSA's use of facial recognition. That's a form of AI, and that's something that TSA is testing out at some airports across the country, and it actually is expanding its use of facial recognition to verify whether a traveler's identity is indeed who they are. And then there's a few high priority areas where DHS is exploring the use of AI. One of those is in identifying fentanyl shipments at the U.S. border. Obviously, fentanyl is such a big issue right now across the country, and stopping the flow of fentanyl into the United States is a high priority. DHS thinks that they can develop algorithms that would actually be able to identify fentanyl shipments from the scans that they do at ports of entry. And then there's also, you know, the use of large language models that DHS is exploring. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is going to pilot the use of large language models, you know, these generative AI models, to help train refugee, asylum, and international operations officers on how to conduct interviews with applicants for lawful immigration. So sort of a training flavor for using AI as well at DHS. And those are just a few of the many pilots that DHS has said it's exploring.
It's also looking into creating its own AI core. What is the latest on the development of that? And can you just kind of give us a brief overview of what that exactly is supposed to be again?
Yeah, DHS announced the idea, the plan for putting together this AI core back in February. The department wants to recruit 50 AI experts into this core this year. And what they're going to do is kind of deploy out to various DHS components and offices to help out on some high priority AI projects. So it's made perhaps some of the ones that I just mentioned earlier. It's kind of modeled after the U.S. Digital Service, where this White House office brings digital service experts in and then assigns them out to various projects across the government. So far, DHS has received more than 3,000 applications for the AI positions. We don't know yet whether they've actually hired any folks at this point or if they're still going through that process. And DHS also recently named a director for its AI core. Michael Boise will serve as the director of this new group. He has actually worked at USCIS in the past. He most recently was working on cloud and AI policy up at the White House Office of Management and Budget. And now he's going to oversee this new group of DHS AI experts who are going to be a part of this core.
And I probably should have asked you this beforehand, but do we have any timeline on this new AI safety and security board? All the memberships are made up. Is there any sort of plan on when and how often they'll be meeting?
Yeah, we don't know exactly when and how often they'll be meeting. Usually these advisory committees meet at least quarterly. So we'll have to see whether they can get all of these clearly busy, high-level executives together quarterly or what exactly they're going to do. We do know from DHS's AI roadmap that they're going to, of course, start meeting and providing some recommendations this year. We're, in late April. So I think you can expect them to start their work within the next couple months so that they can provide those recommendations, initial recommendations, by the end of the year.
All right. We'll have to stand by and see what they come up with. And I'm sure we'll have you back to discuss once they do. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
And you can find more of Justin's reporting at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come on Federal News Network, we hear from the new head of the National Institutes of Health. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom.